Welcome, dear friends. My name's Barbara, and I'm happy to see you. Very happy to see your faces tonight. So for those of you who haven't been with us this whole year, this is the fourth practice period, the practice session of the year. Once a quarter, we were inviting a different bodhisattva to come and befriend us and help us answer the question, how can I help? Which is the question of all bodhisattvas. So we have visited and made good friends with Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, and Sataparibhuta. And tonight we have our fourth bodhisattva, Dharamandara, the earth protector or earth holder bodhisattva. So, I have to tell you that this has been quite a journey. I think really what I do is a topic comes to me, a theme comes to me, and then I go investigate and study and practice and get some insights and get confused and study and practice some more, and then come up with a path. And then that's what I'm sharing with you. So tonight's path was a big one because Protector of the Earth is probably maybe the most important bodhisattva we have at the moment to help us. So all that is to say that the Dharma talk is a little bit long. And I don't know, maybe in the future I'll have a new tradition or way of doing it, but this time this is what happened. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to do a song. We always do music for the bodhisattva. And then I'm going to do a shortish guided meditation on the four elements, and then we'll have the talk. So the song that I'm going to sing for you, and you're welcome to sing along as long as your microphone's muted, is Breathing In, Breathing Out. Very well-known practice song of ours. And then the guided meditation is going to be on the four elements. Both of these practices, when I came to Thai's tradition in Plum Village 25 years ago, these practices are some of the first ones that I remember. So we've been doing these for a long time. And when we really look deeply into them, the insight is pretty amazing. I found this recently, something that Thay said. I'm not sure where I found it, but he says, when you wake up and see that the earth is not just the environment, the earth is in you. You are the earth, and you touch the nature of interbeing. At that moment, you can have real communication with the earth. That is the highest form of prayer. So that's what we'll be doing tonight. So settle yourselves. And if you'd like to sing, you can. If you'd like to just start your meditation now, we'll go from singing into our guided meditation. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. I am blooming as a flower. I am fresh as the dew. I am solid as a mountain. I am firm as the earth. I am free. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. I am water. Reflecting what is real, what is true, and I feel there is space Deep inside of me, I am free, I am free, I am free. Breathing in, I am aware of the fire element in me. I can feel the energy of the sun animating me, fueling my life force, feeding my deep desire to make the most of every moment. Breathing out, I feel the fire of life in me. I am fire. Breathing in, I am aware of the earth element in me. I touch into my body and feel dense weight grounding me. I am solid in my body, like a mountain, which gives me the capacity to be present to all that is. Breathing out, I feel my body anchoring to the earth, settling in and surrendering. I feel the earth in me. I am earth. Breathing in, I am aware of the water element in me. Over 65% of my body is water. I feel the currents of blood, lymph, and synovial fluid moving through me. Breathing out, I become one with the currents of life, always moving and changing, becoming and dissolving. I am water. Breathing in, I am aware of the air element in me. I breathe in and connect with everything in the universe and beyond. I know that the air I breathe has been breathed by the Buddha, by Hitler, and by Thay. I am part of all of it through my breath. Breathing out, I know that I don't control or own any part of my existence. I am deeply grateful to the substances that make me: fire, earth, water, and air. So take a moment to stretch a bit if you'd like. So Tai says about Dharanam Dara, Earth Protector. This bodhisattva helps further communication between human and other species. Earth Holder works to preserve this planet for living beings by taking care of the air, water, and soil. We have to take up the practice of Earth Holder Bodhisattva and make protecting and preserving the earth a top priority. We all have to become the arms and hands of this bodhisattva in order to protect and preserve the earth for future generations. So, when considering which bodhisattva to invite to come be with us to round out our year of practice, a protector of the earth seemed the necessary choice. For who do we need more at this time? However, it was really interesting. I really didn't want to do this one. So I had to examine why. And my feelings, turns out, ranged from this is too big a topic, it's overwhelming. I was feeling guilt and even some shame that I haven't done enough in my life to save the planet. I'm not really an activist, and now it's too late. So, climate catastrophe can become this huge shadow piece that we keep trying to keep at arm's length, as it's just too painful. But as students of the Buddha, we know that instead of pulling away from pain and fear, we need to move closer. We need to give all our attention to those feelings, which can open our hearts and reveal the next step, our path forward. When I began to explore this topic, my heart opened and the material flooded in. Learning about all the efforts of Dharanam Dara helped me to feel a sense of belonging instead of isolation and despair. I realize now that I have no idea where we are in the process of destruction and healing of our planet. But I do know that there are so many signs of potential healing sprouting up everywhere that I choose to give my heart to bet all my energy on transformation through our collective journey of awakening. Recently, I heard a woman named Erin Jones speak. She's an educator in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. She said, the opposite of belonging, she asked the group, what was the opposite of belonging? And no one came close to what she said. She said, the opposite of belonging is fitting in. I'm still thinking about this. And what I understand so far is that the feeling of belonging comes from my heart and from an acceptance of all of who I am. Fitting in comes from the head and implies that you need to limit yourself in order to be acceptable to others. For myself, I see that looking at climate catastrophe with my head and not my heart makes me literally disheartened. I try to see how I can justify my life and fit in, but I can't do it by looking at it that way. It's too big for me to comprehend. And too frightening. So I end up feeling insecure and inadequate. Instead, if I come from my heart, from my natural love for my planetary home, I will know how to be and what to do. So tonight we'll spend some time together. It's always better to do this together. Looking closely at parts of ourselves that need more acknowledgement. That need to be seen clearly through the eyes and hearts of Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. If we are to move out of a seeming paralysis into generating the energy needed to create an evolutionary path of transformation instead of extinction. because this topic is so big, I found myself leaning on the wisdom of others to help me understand and find myself in it all. So we'll start with some messages to give us a foundation for our exploration, to give us heart, and to give us the strength and courage to look into this darkness and claim what's true, to reclaim what's disowned in us. So the philosopher John McMurray reminds us of a core teaching. He says, "In imagination, we feel sure that it would be lovely to live with the full and rich awareness of the world. But in practice, sensitiveness hurts. It is not possible to develop the capacity to see beauty without also developing the capacity to see ugliness, for they are the same capacity. The capacity for joy is also the capacity for pain. We soon find that any increase in our sensitiveness to what is lovely in the world also increases our capacity for being hurt. That is the dilemma in which life has placed us. We must choose between a life that is thin and narrow, uncreative and mechanical, with the assurance that even if it is not very exciting, it will not be intolerably painful, and a life in which the increase in its fullness and creativeness brings a vast increase in delight, but also in pain and hurt." So as students of the Buddha, we know about this. We know how to use our pain and our suffering. Buddhist teacher Norman Fisher writes about this pain. He says, "Love rushes into the absence that is loss, and that love brings inspired action. If we're able to give ourselves to the loss, to move toward it, rather than recoil in an effort to escape, deny, distract, or obscure, our wounded hearts become full, and out of that fullness, we will do things differently, and we will do different things." The Tibetan master Chogyam Trungpa talks about a soft spot, a raw spot, a wounded spot on the body or in the heart, a spot that may emerge in the face of a loss. He calls this sore spot embryonic compassion. Our loss, our wound, is precious to us because it can wake us up to love and to loving action. And our beloved Thay reminds us to challenge our aversion, to become intimate with what is. He says, "What little compassion I've learned has come not from intellectual investigation, but from my actual experience of suffering. When we see that black mud and white snow are neither ugly nor beautiful, when we can see them without discrimination or duality, then we begin to grasp great compassion." So in the talk last quarter, I spoke about the importance of stories, of how the stories we believe and tell about our lives shape us and reflect back both our dilemmas and our wisdom. Roshi Joan Halifax says, "Our story is an artifact of our view." So when we change our view, our story changes. This is why we began the year learning how to develop right view, clear seeing from our friend Manjushri. We learned that we need to ask ourselves, "Are you sure? What is really true in this moment?" Perhaps our greatest challenge right now is to let go of what we think we know and open our story so we can move from paralysis to transformation. Catholic priest and evolutionary theologian Thomas Berry said, "We are in trouble because we do not have a good story. We are between stories. The old story is no longer effective, yet we have not learned the new story. We are talking only to ourselves. We are not talking to the rivers. We are not listening to the wind and the stars. We have broken the great conversation. By breaking that conversation, We have shattered the universe. He continues, with a change of worldview will come an appropriately comprehensive ethics of reverence for all life. With a new perspective regarding our place in this extraordinary unfolding of Earth's history, will emerge a renewed awareness of our role in guiding the evolutionary process at this crucial point in history. The story of paralysis about climate catastrophe sounds like it's already too late. We can't see the big picture, so how can we mobilize? We don't have the technology to make big enough changes. Us humans are just too lazy and distracted. These are some of the beliefs of the gloom and doomers. They don't help. As bodhisattvas, if we want to help, we cannot put our energy into these views. Our teacher Thay says that the energy of worry has become too strong in our society, and it stands in the way of our healing. Reverend Michael Beckwith calls us not to allow what we're against to be bigger than what we're for, and that we are obligated to do spiritual practice on behalf of those who are unable to, who are too busy fighting for survival. So tonight we'll feed the vision of change that we want. We'll set our intentions based on the wisdom of our elders and our visionaries, and we'll claim what we are already doing to transform our society to a sustainable one. We need to see and acknowledge that we are already in the midst of this change. That yes, there is a trajectory of climate disasters happening based on unskillful choices we've made. And that there's also a trajectory of innovative technology to help turn this tide, to make our world sustainable. And perhaps the most crucial trajectory that is growing exponentially is social awareness and understanding of the crises we are in. This might be where we can most find our place to help. Holding the vision of a sustainable, flourishing future is crucial to making change. When the technology comes, we need to have a story big enough to see it and welcome it. Spiritual teacher Krista Tippett says, we create transformative, resilient new realities by becoming transformed, resilient people. There was a worldwide group of young climate leaders who were each invited to ask the Dalai Lama one question, and almost uniformly their questions were about how to deal with feelings of futility. The Dalai Lama said, the cure for futility is compassion. So in our exploration of this challenging issue, we keep returning to what we know best, that our training and wisdom and compassion from our friends Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara is needed now more than ever. This topic of loving and possibly losing our home feels so big that the stories have turned into prayers. Prayers are like poetry in that they condense our heart's longing and speak from that place. Excuse me. Here's an example from Diane Ackerman. Many years ago, when there was an attempt to bring prayer back into public schools, she decided to write a prayer that she felt would be appropriate for all school children. Here it is. It's called School Prayer. In the name of daybreak and the eyelids of morning and the wayfaring moon and the night when she departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, a healer of misery, a messenger of wonder, and an architect of peace. So part of reclaiming ourselves is remembering that awareness of climate change is not a new phenomenon. It is not suddenly blindsiding us with the effects of heat and flooding. Many of us have known this is coming for most of our lifetime and have been part of the environmental movement our whole adult lives. There's been much dedicated effort and caring to get us to this point. We need to acknowledge this and express our gratitude. This helps to reduce reactions of shock and fear in us. Perhaps we're at a turning point where we begin to see every day the results of our actions and our inaction. This can be shocking, but the results should not be a surprise. This is the path we've been taking. Instead of falling into a hole of regret about what we haven't been able to accomplish, we need to use that awareness to understand that this is part of the hero's journey. When everything seems to be lost, that is where the path starts. Wendell Berry says, "It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded steam is the one that sings." Some of us have soundtracks going on in our lives, music that we've listened to for special events or that we just have listened to for many years. In my life, my soundtracks have expressed joy, pain, and despair that I feel at times, and offers me comfort, understanding, hope, and inspiration. The singer-songwriter Jackson Brown has provided a soundtrack that I'm still listening to. In 1974, he put out a song called For a Dancer. So this is almost 50 years ago. And this one verse from it is the voice of Earth Holder. He says, "Keep a fire for the human race. Let your prayers go drifting into space. You never know what may be coming down. Perhaps a better world is drawing near. Just as easy, it could all disappear, along with whatever meaning we might have found. Don't let the uncertainty turn you around. Go and make a joyful sound." On this same album, there's a song called Before the Deluge, which could be describing the state of our planet today. So this awareness has been with me my whole life. This uncertainty about whether our home will be able to continue to sustain us, whether we'll have air to breathe and water to drink. This uncertainty offers us the opportunity to awaken to the reality that we are all in this together and to face this as one family. 30 years ago, Robert and I were part of a group that explored the path of the ancient Maya people. The Mayan calendar has 13-day cycles, so every 13 days, a group of us would get together and do ceremony and pray. Every morning during that time, I would waken and say a prayer that came from the ancient Maya, which I'll share with you here. So, if you would like to close your eyes and imagine that you're living in a community of Maya people during the last half of the first century AD. Perhaps you're in the jungle in Chichen Itza or on the coast in Tulum. You wake in the morning, stand on the earth before the rising sun, and say this prayer. "Feel me here, Mother Earth. It is I, a piece of the earth. I have come to you to awaken the experience of unconditional love. I ask that I be allowed to go inside your heart, for I desire to love. I want to love everything again. I need this love now and for the future, so I may walk in harmony with the earth and the stars once again. I am the eyes that see as Mother Earth sees. I am the ears that hear as Mother Earth hears. I am the mind that knows as Mother Earth knows. I am the heart that feels as Mother Earth feels. I am the voice that speaks as Mother Earth speaks. I am the soul that loves as Mother Earth loves. As in you, so in me, I am now and I am here. Look here, Father Son, it is I, a piece of the sun. I have come to you to understand the meaning of the cosmos. I ask that I be allowed to go inside your memory, for I desire to remember. I want to understand everything again. I need this knowledge now and for the future, so I may walk in harmony with the earth and the stars once again. I am the eyes that see as the Creator sees. I am the ears that hear as the Creator hears. I am the mind that knows as the Creator knows. I am the heart that feels as the Creator feels. I am the voice that speaks as the Creator speaks. I am the soul that loves as the Creator loves. As in you, so in me. I am now. And I am here. When I found this prayer recently, after going through some papers, I didn't remember that this is a prayer to reunite us with the energy of Mother Earth and Father Sun, with nature. That means that the ancient Maya people also felt separated and needed reconnection with their true nature. We don't know what happened in their society to create the separation, but apparently this has been the human condition for a long time. Our need to reconnect with our source, both spiritually and physically. The need to remind ourselves every day that beyond dualism, we are the earth and sky, right now and right here. So we're already taking the long view, stepping back and looking forward to open our hearts and find courage to face the climate crisis here now. In my life, when faced with difficult choices or obstacles, it has always helped me to stand back from the issue and see what's most important long term. With the eyes of Manjushri, we do our best to see where to put our attention and where to let it go. One way to do this is to listen to some thought leaders of our time, wise ones to help us understand how to hold the big view of what's happening. So we turn first to mythologist Joseph Campbell, who says, "The mystical theme of the space age is this: the world as we know it is coming to an end. The world as the center of the universe, the world divided from the heavens, the world bound by horizons in which love is reserved for members of the in-group, that is the world that is passing away. Our divided schizophrenic worldview, with no mythology adequate to coordinate our conscious and unconscious, that is what is coming to an end. The space age demands that we change our ideas about ourselves, but we want to hold on to them. There are no horizons in space, and there can be no horizons on our experience." And the message of the spiritual visionary Barbara Marx Hubbard was, "Our crisis is a birth. Birth looks messy and painful. It can look like death. Perhaps this is what is happening with our planet. We're in a birthing crisis, not a death crisis. Can we really know the outcome?" Manjushri asks, "Are we sure of our view? Can we hold birthing as a possibility?" So there are two wise leaders who use the fulcrum of wildness to anchor their messages. Both offer much to help us clarify our view of what's going on and therefore to ground our aspirations. The first is Victoria Lures, who wrote a book based on her movement called Church of the Wild. Victoria is a scholar of classical theology and a Christian pastor who never felt comfortable inside a church, so she took her worship outdoors and developed practices based on intimacy with nature. She says, "The word wild is not meant in the colloquial sense of out of control. Rather, I use it to refer to the natural, innate way the world was created, not controlled or tamed or domesticated. Reclaiming wild is reclaiming who you're meant to be, who the world is meant to be, which isn't static. Wild means swirling and dynamic and even loving relationship, because all wild things are naturally interconnected." She talks about the need to go into the wilderness, to connect with the sacred, to spend some time shedding our identities, which can most easily be done when we're immersed in the natural world. I remember Ty reminding us to spend time in nature. When someone asked him what to do if they lived in the city, Ty said to make it a priority to get out of the city and immerse yourself in the natural world regularly. So Lourdes steps back in time to 5th century BCE, when the Greek philosopher Heraclitus used the word logos to articulate a kind of intelligent life force embedded in and interconnecting all things. Lourdes claims the same concept can be found in all civilizations. For example, it's what is known to us as the Tao. Logos is a relational force, inherent in all things, holding together all things. It's dynamic, moving, and constantly changing. This was the understanding of logos until the 4th century AD, when, for some reason, the definition of logos shifted to word. So for some reason, whatever the causes and conditions, Christianity began to define logos as a thing, a word, instead of a dynamic, constantly changing process, a conversation. Listen to how this shift in translation changes the impact of the Bible verse in John that's so familiar. Instead of, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," we have, "In the beginning was the conversation, and the conversation was with God, and the conversation was God." This is what Buddha is expressing when he says that all things are impermanent and subject to change. Life is not a word spoken from above. It's not a noun or a thing. It's a dynamic, ever-changing conversation of which each of us is a part. There's no one sitting out this conversation. We're all participating through our thoughts, our words, and our actions. When I read this, I realized that I had been thinking of impermanence mainly in linear time. Things used to be that way, and now they're this way, and in the future they'll be different again. But when I'm able to understand impermanence in this more dynamic way, it's much larger and can be scarier, but I also feel more a part of everything, not separate in time or space. In this mindset, I can begin to grasp what the James Webb Telescope is photographing, the time and space before the origin of our universe. So as bodhisattvas in training, we started this year with our question, how can I help? And perhaps this question is more crucial with the issue of climate crisis than any other question. Mythologist Michael Mead has a response to our question. He says, "Could nature, now overburdened and sorely mistreated, be calling on each of us to take up the thread of genius that is closest to our own nature and set to the work of helping to reimagine and reweave the whole divine thing?" Perhaps our greatest work now is to nurture a loving, creative way of thinking and feeling of being in the world, to hold the door open for possibility. Science agrees, expressed by biologist Andreas Weber, when he says that Earth is currently suffering from a shortage of our love. We must go beyond taking care of the Earth and risk falling in love. Even if the diagnosis is dire, and it is, when we love someone, we risk everything to help them, because life is worth it. Lourdes says, we do not need to minimize or overlook the pain and tragedy we encounter as we live in this time of interwoven crises. Eventually, when we recognize that the pain is directly connected with our love, we can embrace it. We can move into actions of restoration that are firmly planted in love. Our second visionary who anchors in wildness is named David Hinton. He's a renowned translator of Chinese poetry, and he wrote a remarkable book called Wild Mind, Wild Earth, Our Place in the Sixth Extinction. He lays out how we got here, what we're doing that is helping, and what the possible outcomes look like. So as Lourdes does, Hinton talks about the fundamental rupture between mind and earth in the fourth century, saying that this dualism is the opposite of kinship. It tells us we're set apart from and better than nature. He says, quote, togetherness is a primordial value, deeper and more ancient even than self-awareness. It inheres in the body itself. We instinctively need togetherness, and togetherness requires kinship. Hinton shares that our current meditation practice is crucial to the transformation we need so desperately. He says, it's clear that meditation itself is a radical ecological practice. It is a remarkably simple and direct way to heal that wound of consciousness torn from the tissue of existence. Once mind is empty and silent, perception becomes a particularly spiritual form of ecological practice. Awareness, the opening of consciousness, functions as a mirror, reflecting the world with perfect clarity, allowing no distinction between inside and outside. I remember Ty announcing in a retreat many years ago that our species may not survive. It was a remarkable moment, waking me up in a new way, opening my eyes to the long view. Hinton carries this message, saying that every major destruction on our planet has been the foundation for something new to be created. He says, this fresh and exquisite world we inhabit is also aftermath, ruins, and its destruction can only open new possibilities that will likely be even more valuable and beautiful. For each mass extinction leads to more complex and remarkable array of diversity because it begins with a more complex array. Our moment is only one slice through a history of constant evolutionary transformation, traversing hundreds of millions of years and including five mass extinction events before our own. So I want to invite you to maybe close your eyes and really listen as a meditation to Hinton's description of our possible future and how we can write it. The cosmos is pure mystery, ceaselessly evolving in a process of transformation that is both rife with creation and ravaged with destruction. And yet it is slow and steady in its processes, even tranquil. When we dwell as integral to earth and cosmos, we inhabit our largest selves, our wholeness. Then, rather than clinging to a permanent self, a stable and enduring center of identity that sustains itself in turn by clinging to a constellation of assumptions and ideas and answers, we can share that tranquility. Even as Earth's process of transformation passes through the great vanishing of our contemporary mass extinction event on its way to whatever new web of diversity may arise from it. It's a tranquility suffused by that new emotion the cosmos is learning in us. Joyful grief and gratitude. Celebration and despair. Reverence and anger. Wonder and awe and love. Love and kinship. All of it tangled with a sense of radical wildness and freedom that comes of existing not as a circumscribed identity center, but as woven into a dynamic and generative cosmos, a wild freedom in which we move through everyday experience with the tranquility of the cosmos, free even of death itself. For when death comes, whether our own or global mass extinction, it comes as the existence tissue simply unfurling its next possibility. Okay, so now let's return to the historical dimension. come back. To educate ourselves on the work being done now. So first I want to review some of the actions of our own Plum Village community that you may not be aware of. Our teacher was a real leader in bringing the need for climate action forward in society's awareness. Ty recounts, in the 1960s and 1970s, our Buddhist community and friends in the peace and environmental movements worked to help increase awareness of the situation of the earth. In 1969, sponsored by the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, we set up an organization called Great Togetherness. We spoke about environmental deterioration, the depletion of natural resources, overpopulation, and hunger. We spoke about war, and we spoke about what can be done to create a way out of these pressing problems. We were not acting as governments, which hold their own national interests paramount, but on behalf of all the people of Earth, in the spirit of great togetherness. At that time, there was not yet much public discussion or awareness of environmental issues. We continued holding retreats, Dharma discussions, and conferences to bring greater awareness. With the collaboration of scientists and environmentalists from all over the world, little by little, all of us working in this way were able to bring about more awareness of the situation of the planet. And then in the 1980s, Ty wrote in the introduction to his book called The Sun, My Heart, he wrote, "Our insight and our language are inseparable from the times in which we live. For many years now, the East has followed the West down the path of technological and material development, to the point of neglecting its own spiritual values. In our world, technology is the main force behind economics and politics. But those in the forefront of science have begun to see something similar to what the spiritual disciplines of the East discovered long ago. If we can survive our times, the gap that separates science and spirituality will close, and East and West will meet one another on the path to discover true mind. Those in whom the seeds of this important endeavor have already been sown can start working towards that convergence right now using their own daily mindful lives." That's us, folks. And then in the early 2000s, after studying in depth a report from the United Nations on climate survival, Ty spoke about the possible ending of our species, and he decided that the monastics would adopt a vegan diet in response. In 2015, the International Earthholder Community was born of Plum Village practitioners. Its focus is to use mindful practices to protect our precious planet. Their goals include engaging in love, not fear, engaging in togetherness, not separation, and engaging both diligently and aimlessly. Their work has included retreats in nature with several hundred people, including representatives from various indigenous communities. And then earlier this year, Plum Village offered an online course called Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet, based on the book of that name authored by Thay and Sister True Dedication. You may know about this course. It had over 750 participants from 60 countries. Each week, so much rich material was offered, including teachings and guided meditations from both monastic and lay teachers, and ways of sharing together. The course directly addresses the issues we're all holding, including working with difficult feelings, caring for ourselves as we care for the planet, and holding our hearts open to the future through taking refuge in community, and of course, falling in love. The course is being offered again this month. It starts in just a few days, and I encourage anyone who's considering to jump in. So one of the lay teachers in the course is Christiana Figueres, who is the key figure in gaining consensus among all nations for the Paris Climate Agreement in 2014. She came to her lifelong work of climate transformation through loss. She comes from Costa Rica, which has always been the home of an extraordinarily rich and diverse variety of plants and animals. As a young mother, she wanted her daughters to meet a species that she had fallen in love with as a teenager called the golden frog. But she found it was extinct. The shock of this news created the resolve, the vow in her to stop this harmful destruction caused by humans. And she has spent her life doing this work. It was after another personal loss that Christiana came to Thay's teachings and became his student, which she says saved her life. In the course, she shares about the practice of Avalokiteshvara, deep listening. Christiana says that there would have been no way to achieve the Paris Agreement without this practice. Her challenge was to gain consensus from every nation, even though they had a wide variety of needs and priorities, often seemingly contradictory. So first, she had to understand the motivations of each nation in order to offer them what they needed. To do this, she practiced deep listening. Christiana explains that deep listening has two levels. The first is learning how to completely give your attention. The second is learning how not to be triggered by the content of what is being said. The way we do this is to learn the context for each person's understanding and beliefs. So she went to the representatives of each country and asked questions to find out what their visions and aspirations were. She explained that with deep listening, you have to be ready to touch the pain behind the views being shared before you can come to resolution. From the process of her deep listening, everyone from every nation came to the conclusion that no one benefits from uncontrolled climate change. And that is how they came to consensus. As students of Thay, we have to understand that we're part of something much, much bigger than ourselves. When we invite the bell, when we breathe in and out consciously, stopping our worries and distracting thoughts for that moment, we are part of the energy of peace, of open awareness, the field in which other possibilities can manifest. We are part of the Sangha of Plum Village practitioners, which enabled Christiana Figueres to do her work. Our practice makes possible this kind of worldwide effort. Our energy and support of Plum Village has been part of creating this Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet course, offering climate activists methods to sustain and care for themselves so they can continue to work without burning out or falling into despair. Our daily practice holds the energy of love, which sustains our confidence that this turning of the earth contains the seeds of transformation into something wonderful that we haven't imagined yet. Perhaps our job isn't to fix as much as to carry the faith and promise anchored in our love, to have our hearts and minds open when opportunities for healing arise. In 2017, 13 Indigenous leaders from all directions of the world came together to ask, what is the current state of the world and what do we need to do? These wisdom weavers did ceremony and prayer and then talked for 4 days. Their message to us includes, first, drop into your heart. They talked about healing the imbalance in male and female energies. And they said, the most unselfish thing you can do now is to heal yourself. When we heal ourselves, we become holders of the vision of a sustainable future. So to keep our hearts and minds open to possibilities, and our creative juices flowing, I'd like to spend a few more minutes just highlighting a few things, very few things going on right now that I consider lights in the darkness. This is calling out the goodness in the spirit of our friend Sadapar Bhutta. It's essential to continue doing this so we can hold our great aspiration of healing and transforming our future. The first light in the darkness I want to share is the story of Lewis Island on the Outer Hebrides of Scotland and how the citizens saved their homeland by restoring intimate conversation with their landscape. Victoria Lewis shares the story, saying that people referred to this bogland as a nothing place and an unproductive wilderness. Then, in 2004, a gas and energy corporation proposed building turbines across the moorland, which would have decimated the biosystem. In response, 4 residents launched a campaign to inspire citizens to restore intimacy with their land through storytelling, to share detailed and loving experiences they had had with particular places through story, poems, songs, and visual art. Remembering the history of places and sharing the love for them. This is the art of flower watering we learned about. The 4 residents gathered all this material of love and presented it to the city council, and the gas company's proposal was rejected. Most important, the campaign revived the citizens' sense of kindred belonging to their place. The second light in the darkness comes from Suzanne Simard. She's a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. In her book called Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, she says, forests are regenerative systems. They've evolved that way. The old help the young, the large help the small. It's reciprocal and the network grows. Out of it emerges incredible stuff like the ability to sequester carbon in our ecosystems, the productivity of a beautiful cathedral forest, the sense of wonder and health and vitality that we get when we interact with that incredible place. And in our own societies, look at what we've achieved and look at the joy we've developed. Listening to the symphony, watching our children grow, it's full of joy. We're built for that. She continues, hope is based on understanding that our ecosystems are meant to heal themselves. And yes, there are tipping points. And yes, if we don't make changes, they can collapse. But they can also go the other direction. The system will respond if we make these choices. It will rebuild and reorganize itself again in a way that is going to be healthy for even the human society. We have all the tools. We have all the fundamental building blocks. We just need to make good decisions. And similarly to Suzanne's expression, the third light I'd like to bring up is called biomimicry. Have you heard of it? Biomimicry means copying nature. This is the creation of scientist Janine Benyus, who says the secrets to a sustainable world are all around us. Co-founder of the Biomimicry Institute, she's been working for decades on this innovative approach to healing our climate issues. In her work, Janine doesn't just learn about nature, she learns directly from nature. She lets nature mentor her in what to do and how to heal. She asks, what do the organisms need? Here are just a few innovations already being studied. Scientists have found a certain type of fungi that digests plastic. Researchers at Uppsala University in Sweden are making a battery with algae that contains no heavy metals or toxic chemicals and can be charged in 11 seconds. Researchers are developing a robot to use in search and rescue operations based on a design inspired by cockroaches. And one of these days, we may be able to light our homes with lamps filled with glowing bacteria. So you might want to contemplate how our code of ethics, our mindfulness trainings, reflects the ethics of biomimicry, which goes like this. Nature runs on sunlight, uses only the energy it needs, fits form to function, recycles everything, rewards cooperation, banks on diversity, demands local expertise, curbs excesses from within, and taps the power of limits. Nature relentlessly creates conditions conducive to life. So the fourth light in the darkness is the Earthshot Prize, founded by Prince William in 2020. This prize is given for innovation in ways to respond to climate issues around the world. Christiana Figueres is one of the judges selecting the five prize winners, and she reports that this year there were 600 entries. There's a lot going on. So there's so much more to explore. The deep ecology of the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha as a shaman, how our ethics might shift and change in priority as we open to our role as evolutionaries, and what it means to be an evolutionary being. I hope our time together has opened some doors for you and that your exploration will be deep and wonderful. I'll end with a couple more messages from our compatriots who are lighting our way along the path. From Robin Wall Kimmerer, author of Braiding Sweetgrass, she says, knowing that you love the earth changes you, activates you to defend and protect and celebrate. But when you feel that the earth loves you in return, that feeling transforms the relationship from a one-way street into a sacred bond. And from poet laureate Ada Limón, what would happen if we decided to survive more, to love harder? What if we stood up with our synapses and flesh and said no, no to the rising tides? Stood for the many mute mouths of the sea, of the land? What would happen if we used our bodies to bargain for the safety of others, for Earth? If we declared a clean night? If we stopped being terrified? And finally, from Pakistani-American poet Aisha Siddiqua, I'd follow love into extinction. So, dear friends, our meditation opens our heart and leads us into love and connection and into choosing to live with moral beauty. Whenever our response is to cherish all life, to take only what we need, to respect and delight in the unique beauty of each being, we're engaging in moral beauty. We are forces of change. We are pockets of light. We point the way to transformation and healing. We're not viewing this from the outside. We are in the middle of this process. We can't see what's going to happen around the next bend, much less in 5 or 50 years. So let's choose a story that is one we want. Let's set our deepest prayers and intentions and fuel them with our energy of loving mindfulness and great imagination. We find ways to deepen our love for our home and to experience our Mother Earth loving us. We let our actions come from love, openness, and tranquility. We hold the promise of a healing world and do all we can to be part of the flowering. We revel in the possibilities. With 2 minutes to spare. So we don't have any plans from now on, but there's been a lot of energy expressed about wanting to continue on to practice together and to move forward into 2024 in some way. So let's revel in the possibilities of what might happen. And we'll see. Thank you, everyone, so much. Thank you for being here. Are there any announcements or anything? It's so good to have all the Sanghas together. It's really wonderful to be Sangha dating. We might be going steady pretty soon.
Barbara, I just want to say, that was a masterpiece. I hope that there is some way that gets available to a great many people. That needs to be widely available. Just a masterpiece. And I thank you so much for that. I can't really express how amazing that really was. Thank you.
Karen speaks for all of us, and I just want to say this recording will be on the website along with the other three.
Yeah, this needs to go way, way out into the world. It's my opinion.
Thank you, everyone. So lovely to be together. Have a wonderful season of My winter season is always, my motto has always been hibernate and celebrate. So that's what I'm doing. Hope you do the same or do whatever makes you happy. Enjoy this beautiful life that we have.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Lily, I look for that prayer